rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Downloaded right to your PC.
Your riff rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for joining me. 313-298-WRIF. I'm always amazed. I've been doing this a long time. A lot of you have been listening a long time, so I'm always amazed. I don't know why, but when people write and they say, this is the first time I ever heard your show, so I should keep repeating that number, 313-298-WRIF, because this is one of these phone-in talk shows. Most of the time on WRIF, we play great riff rock and roll, but we take a little time out to do this public service show, and we invite you, the listener of WRIF, to phone us, give us your opinion. I'm going to give you mine, and I'm actually sort of understating. I was going to say, sometimes I give strong opinions. I mean, I always do. Because I have strong beliefs, just like most of you do as well. So don't, what do they used to say, you know, like the thing about don't, I don't get angry, I get even or something like that. But in other words, don't get mad. Grab the phone and say, yeah, I don't agree with you. Or if it makes you think of something to add, grab the phone and say, yeah. Or say, well, you know, any number of things. I mean, this is what the program is here for. For you, the Riff listener, 313-298-WRIF. And also, if you'd like to email me, it's calltalkyes, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And why didn't I take my Sudafed? I don't have a cold or anything, but it's this perpetual, I mean, it's not very pleasant to talk about. What do they call it? A post-nasal drip. Sometimes it drives me into that. You've heard this before, you know. It's all every winter. I don't know. I don't, and, you know, knock on plastic here, that I never get colds or the flu. But I always, perpetually through the winter, have this little teeny tickle in the back of my throat. I shouldn't talk about it. But one of the ways you could help me out is to call, and we'll talk. Now, you're wondering, wait a minute, what are we going to talk about? I just looked at something on our screen, which I won't even bother to tell you. Oh, my Gaia. Anyway, Vice President Cheney shot a fellow hunter. What is up with that? It was an accident. He was out hunting. That's what he loves to do when he's not making awful governmental decisions or making lots of money from Halliburton. You know, he still gets paid by Halliburton, right? He was the president. And actually, without going into a long thing about it, the people that were in present at this incident where he shot a millionaire attorney from Austin, does he have any friends that aren't millionaires? Maybe when you're that high up in politics, it is just such a total racket that you're not going to be hanging out with ordinary people. I mean, did Clinton ever hang out with ordinary people? I don't know. I'd probably not. Once you get to be that wealthy, it's only fellow wealthy people. Anyways, he shot this millionaire attorney from Austin, and they say Harry Whittington is doing fine. It was at a Texas ranch, and the shooting was first reported by the Corpus Christi Caller Times, but this is odd, but consistent with the kind of secrecy and arrogance that we've come to expect from this administration, and particularly from Cheney. That they didn't disclose the accident until 24 hours after it happened. Now there's lots of speculation about how, in what condition is Harry Whittington, the guy that got shot by Vice President Dick Cheney. Every report, at least the initial report, said that he's doing fine, that he wound up taking a few pellets. And it's not like they're going after Bird, so it's probably Bird shot. It's not like this, I'm forgetting all this, double-aught shot, right, which is, I think, like 6 or 8 pellets in a shot, each one like the weight of a .32 caliber. Now, all you gun guys are grabbing the phones if I'm wrong. But you get hit one by one of those, it's curtains. But if it's Bird shot, you're going after quail, or what were they after here? Some little covey of quail. That's right, they were after quail, so... You don't want to blast them apart. I assume he eats them as well. Well, in terms of being a target, it could very well be that Cheney himself finally is becoming a target for the investigation of Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald. Remember, he's the guy that indicted Cheney's aide, Scooter Libby. Scooter Libby is under indictment on charges that he lied to FBI agents in the grand jury about how he learned about the CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity and when he told reporters. And if you're going, what? Sometimes if you're not really paying attention very deeply to all of this, and it's so sordid and it's so complex, and it is so behind the scenes. There's not an inkling of transparency in this this government. They want to do everything in stealth, and then they say, "Trust me, trust me." There's weapons of mass destruction. Trust me, I'm not going to misuse the fact that I am unconstitutionally tapping people's lines. Trust me, I'll handle natural disasters like Katrina and all that. So. It turns out that both Republican and, let me put it another way, Democratic and Republican senators are calling for the special counsel to investigate Cheney and others as well in the CIA leak probe. Now, here's the deal, that it apparently that Cheney's office authorized an aide to give secret information to reporters about Iraq. What they were trying to do in the run-up to the war, because they were very nervous, because they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And pardon me, those of you that are still thinking, well, maybe they sent him to Syria, or maybe they, had them all hidden, or maybe they sent them all to Mars, or something like that. I don't know. Keep listening, but don't call in about this, because there never were any weapons of mass destruction. Cheney, Bush, Powell, and the rest of them knew it. There were none. But they were worried that this was going to come out, so they were trying to undercut the few critics that could get the public ear to say, hey, there's none. And one of the things, without repeating this very complex story, they outed the CIA agent. They made public the identity of this woman who was the wife of a critic of the Bush administration that exposed one of the major lies, that there were no, there was nothing going on the part of Saddam Hussein to create nuclear weapons. And so they just thrashed, outed anybody that was straying from the party line. So Cheney could be in big trouble. The whole Bush administration is sort of a combination of the Warren Harding USS Grant and where wasn't there other some other really and Nixon, and a lot of these guys go back there like Cheney and Rumsfeld and what have you, and they didn't learn their lesson. They didn't learn their lesson whatsoever. Let's see. Ray wrote into calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Hey, Pete, I know never to go hunting with Dirty Dick Cheney now, eh? Too bad the Nuge wasn't with him. No, that's not nice. Isn't the Nuge down there in Crawford? Well, it's pretty close to where they were hunting. All right. This cartoon thing is still going on. There's more demonstrations today, Sunday. Ultra-nationalist Turks chanting vengeance pelted the French consulate in Istanbul with eggs as about 2,500 pro-Islamic demonstrators shouted, "Down with America, Israel, and Denmark." Now, a lot of these don't have a tremendous number of people participating. And this stereotype is that Muslims all over the world have gone nuts about these cartoons that are caricatures of Muhammad and Allah. Like 30,000 people were involved in a peaceful rally in southeast Turkey, which is fine. Peaceful rallies are okay about anything, particularly when you feel you've been offended. But all of this is right-wing. You notice this? It was a right-wing publication in Denmark that put this out there, almost like a purposeful provocation. Did they think? I mean, hopefully their intent was so miserable that it was only to gain circulation for the paper. And not as some have charged, that this is part of a wider conspiracy to provoke a Muslim reaction, to actually encourage and engender the so-called clash of civilizations or of religions, which nobody in the West is interested in, and 95% of anyone in the East or the Middle East is interested in as well. So you have these right-wingers in Denmark starting all of this, and then these right-wingers among the Muslim population, because that's who they are. They're these right-wing fundamentalists, these proto-fascists that want these authoritarian governments to rule over people. So it's these right-wingers who are always making all this trouble. They always create these problems. Just like, I mean, can you imagine how many problems we've had since the Bush regime took over? I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. Iran, pardon me, rejected an accusation by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that it fanned violent protest over caricatures of Islam's Prophet Muhammad and demanded an apology from Rice, saying that that could reduce the growing tension. Now, to many of us, or maybe to all of us, you think, how could these people get so nuts about a caricature? In other words, in return, this newspaper in Tehran, in Iran, said they were going to run a contest for cartoons about the Holocaust. So they were going to take something that was extraordinarily iconic. In other words, something that represented some great, how would you say this? Something of great importance to us in the West, and they were going to make fun of it. Well, what they suggested, without repeating it, I found pretty offensive, but I don't think any of us are going to go out and, I don't know, is there an Iranian embassy? I guess there is in Washington. And like Christians or Jews or people like that, or just those of us who are part of the Western tradition. So we're not going to go rioting. But it occurred to me, and it may occur to you as well. In fact, if things occur to you, please call me, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby here with you on the Night Call show. That these people have a lot of other issues with us. I mean, we're over in their face. I mean, the United States has been messing around in the Middle East and the West, when you talk about Britain and France, for close to 100 years. And always with dirty deeds. I mean, some of it, I don't think any of us would disagree. We're dirty deeds, the kind of colonialism and imperialism that just wreaked havoc on those countries and those cultures. And now, I mean, we have troops in Afghanistan. We have troops in the Middle East. We're backing different governments over in that region. If you can imagine, the only thing I could imagine as an analogy would be if Arab nations were fighting wars in Canada and Mexico. I mean, how we'd feel. I mean, we'd be a little bent, right? I would. I mean, how would you like that? Countries from 3,000 and 4,000 miles away. Well, it's more than 3,000. Why? How far is it? 6,000, 4,000. Anyways, that would kind of bend us out of shape. And we probably wouldn't have much good to say about those people coming that from that far away to be that close of us, close to us. And how about if they were financing governments on our periphery that were hostile to us? And we saw as intruders and interlopers in the Western Hemisphere. We'd be mighty PO'd, wouldn't we? Well, they are, too. And they've got even more issues. I mean, like Iran, particularly, we say, you know, these people are crazy. And apparently there's a growing number of people that fear Iran. Do you fear Iran? Well, what's Iran going to do to us? I mean, it's impossible for them to do anything to us. 313-298-WRIF. I mean, fortunately, it was only about 27%. But people say they fear North Korea. And they fear Iraq. Why would they fear Iraq? I mean, isn't that our ally now? I don't get all this. I mean, that's what this country now is based on, fear. And, of course Bush Co., to create the necessity for this almost half-trillion-dollar war budget, needs to keep us always on this knife's edge of fear. Because if we weren't fearful, we would say, you know, this doesn't seem like the best idea to be spending all of our money on preparation for war. Now, we don't have any imperial enemies the way we did with the Soviet Union, that also had multi-trillion-dollar investments in weaponry and nuclear weapons and all that. I mean, our main adversaries are guys with box cutters that if you don't install the proper security measures, we know that they can do some terrible things to us. We've already experienced that. Where they're actually fighting, we have the most sophisticated weapon systems and intelligence and what have you in the world. And you may remember quite a while ago, I keep coming back to this image, about one of the insurgents in Iraq who said, "I prefer to fight barefoot because I can get around easier." And he has a Kalashnikov. So for this, we need $500 billion, right? Somewhere or other, I was looking for something, I can't even find it. Anyways, so, I mean, that doesn't excuse the kind of manner in which these right-wing Muslims have responded. I mean, they should be offended, I guess, or they can be offended. I don't think they should be. I don't know where they can. I mean, you can take the things, and I'm not going to tell you which they are. Maybe you can just extrapolate from what I've said. There's things that are very, very precious to me in terms of ideas and thoughts, and I hear them insulted in an offensive ways continually. And I don't like that. I don't like to hear that. What lengths do we go to? What lengths do we go to? All right, let me see if I can get my little mice here out. I've got so many of them. Come on out, little mouse. Yeah, all right. Okay, here we go. Now I can get some of your calls on the line. Let's go to Chris. Chris is in Rochester. Hey, Chris, it's Peter Werbe. You're on WRIF. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter. First off, I want to preface our discussion with my brother is an active special forces pilot who is in Iraq right now. Have had lengthy discussions with them, and before I make conjecture on any of your comments, I'm trying to understand, where do you stand? Do you feel we should pull out now, or?
Well, I think I think we ought to pull out immediately before any more of our troops get killed, and before our troops kill any more Iraqis, and before the whole situation in the Middle East explodes in our face and winds up with a lot of worst case scenarios that I could imagine. How about you?
Appreciate that, and I will say my brother did try to retire here 2 months ago. He denied that. He's a special forces pilot, and he was told, "Well, you're one of 20 people in the entire military that can do your job, so we need you there."
Wait. You keep breaking up. Something. He must be on a cell. But are you saying he's a special forces pilot?
Yes, he is. He flies black helicopters for the U.S. Army.
Right.
And he tried to retire a couple months ago, and they told him he could not retire because there's only a handful of guys able to do his job.
There's 20 guys in all of Iraq?
20 guys in all of the U.S. military that are able to do his job right now.
Wow.
Well, you know, Peter, I had discussions with my brother, lengthy ones, visiting him. And, you know, one of the things he pointed out was, you know, we're there right now, and we are there. And he said, you know, the pullout now is really a countervention. And people have to understand this is a different type of war than the Cold War. I noticed you commented on the Cold War. And this is a knock on doors and ask questions type of war. This involves, in his opinion, this type of war cannot be fought with news and extra troops. This is a community policing effort, you know, similar to what we have in maybe oppressed parts of our own nation, where it requires community policing to turn a situation around. And he attributed that, he made that a simile to the situation in Iraq. You've got to know who belongs in what neighborhood and who belongs where.
But why is the United States doing this? Why are we spending our fortune and our lives in an effort that we had no business taking part in the first place and has turned out to be disastrous militarily, disastrous for Iraq, disastrous for our budgets, and there's no end in sight?
Well, I think, you know, how we got there, I think, is definitely up to dispute and a whole different discussion, Peter. But what to do now, I think we have to set a goal. And if we were to pull out now, what are we leaving behind? I mean, are we assuming that, you know, the proclaimed jihad in Iraq is going to come to a rest because American troops are no longer on their soil?
Well, here's what I think we could do. First off, the United States, rather than declaring war everywhere, ought to think about declaring peace. I mean, all of a sudden there was a secret order that said everybody's getting on those big transport planes, and by Tuesday everybody would be gone. The context of civil war, which the United States intervention, its illegal and unnecessary attack on Iraq created, there would be probably something really terrible go on. Other people have said no, not necessarily, but there could be ways that the United States, first off, would say we are not taking part in any more military offensive actions in Iraq, and we want to withdraw, as the majority of Iraqi people in every poll has shown want us to, and we want to effectuate that in the most creative way imaginable, so we don't do any more damage than the United States has already done there.
I see what you're saying, and you know, as a U.S. citizen and as somebody who has his only blood brother over there, I would support an initiative. I would put the ballot right now by the Iraqi people to yes or no question: do you want U.S. military support remaining in Iraq? I'd like to see the results on that poll.
Well, everybody, all the non-electoral polls, and every faction, including the ones, maybe they're just giving lip service to it, but they all say, that they would like to have a, withdrawal. All right, thank you very much. I gotta move on here. Wayne, one of the things that's happening, when you talk about, community policing, whenever you have a foreign occupying army, in a country, as we know from all over the world, whether it's people that are as similar as the British in Ireland or the United States in Vietnam or anywhere else where people have occupied a territory where at least some portion, if not the majority, of civilians don't want you there, the occupying troops begin taking casualties from irregulars. They don't know who is their enemy. It's not frontal warfare like World War II or something like that. So more and more abuses take place. Doors are knocked down. Families are killed, as we've seen so many times, as collateral damage. I mean, listen to this. British investigate after paper shows soldiers abusing Iraqi teens. The British government said today it was investigating the allegation that British soldiers viciously kicked, butted, and beat Iraqi teenagers in custody at an army compound in Basra in 2004. Details of the attack attacks captured on a home video that was said to have been made by a British army corporal in Basra in southern Iraq was published today by the News of the World. The newspaper, whose front page showed a photograph of two soldiers raining blows on a cowering young man, turned out that they were early teens wearing jeans and a T-shirt, said it had obtained the video from a disgusted whistleblower. And I won't go on with all of the details, but it says the video shows scenes in which the soldiers kicked the youth, striking one in the genitals, as well as butting, punching, and beating them with their fists and batons for a total of 42 blows in 60 seconds worth of footage. It said that one soldier can also be seen swearing and kicking a dead Iraqi twice in the face, yelling, oh yes, you're going to get it, yes, naughty little boys, the person who leaked the video, these were apparently being shown as entertainment by these British troops. The one who released the video said these Iraqis were just kids. Most haven't even got shoes on. He added that the eight British soldiers involved in the attack were pumped up and out of control. And that's not unusual for occupying troops that generally despise... Sometimes people say, oh, I really love the Iraqi people. But oftentimes they despise the people that they're occupying. They don't want to be in the country in the first place. How many American soldiers do you think want to be in Iraq? Not too many, right? How many of them think that almost every Iraqi, even if when they see them, greet them with a big smile, could be an insurgent behind their back, right? 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe, and let's go. I guess our next. We got this little button that says next, and it's not happening. But here's John in Dearborn. John, hi. It's Peter Werbe, and you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I'm calling in reference to your weapons of mass destruction issue with Bush, and there were none there.
Yeah.
I was wondering, this has been a manufactured story because Bush felt there was a personal vendetta against him and his family by Saddam, and he better take them out now while he has the resources to do it, rather than wait till after he's a retired president and have to be looking over his shoulder constantly. Because somebody could catch up with him from Saddam's regime.
Well, I'll tell you, John, that people have made a lot of that. You know, he tried to kill my daddy. Well, it's not even clear. That's never even been proved that Saddam Hussein was behind the attack on Senior Bush in Kuwait. And who knows? I mean, he could have had personal satisfaction. Didn't Bush wind up with Saddam's revolvers as kind of a Batman-like trophy or something? But, I mean, to kind of reduce it down just to a personal vendetta, even if it was that with Bush himself, who we know is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, the idea to invade and occupy Iraq is of long-stand planning by these neoconservatives who put forth the idea of that as long ago as, as a couple of years at least, before Bush even got in office. So, maybe there's some personal satisfaction, but most of it is geopolitical, having to do with control of oil resources, the ability, not the ability, but the affirmation to affirm the ability of the United States to project military power anywhere in the world in a unilateral manner, to not be constrained by anything as so, antique as the United Nations, which, of course, we've seen the results of that strategy. Things have just gotten worse. All right, thanks a lot, John. I appreciate your call. Now, let me get another call in before we go to a break. Here's Phil in Detroit. Phil, it's Peter Werbe. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
How's it going, Peter?
Going good. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you were making comments earlier that... who's actually benefiting from the war? You know, why are we going to war? Why are they drawing it out? Why don't they finish? Well, I hate to use this term, but it's Bush and his cronies. I mean, who's making money off this war? And why would they want it to end?
Right, right. It kind of works for them.
Off of it.
Well, and also, for a while, it looked like it was going to work for them politically. Now, it's you know, really going down the drain for them. Real quickly, Phil, let me just tell you that Bush's overall job approval is 40%, and his approval on the handling of our economy is 39%. So that's just the hardcore, you know, Republicans. They're the only people sticking with him, and the overwhelming majority of people would like to get rid of him and the Republicans.
Well, I agree there. I think what sums it up is I seen a bumper sticker on the back of a car today, and it was a beautiful statement. It said, "Somewhere in Texas, there's a village missing an idiot."
Well, I've seen that one before. Yeah. Now, I said to a friend of mine that, I mean, she said, "I'm really worried that Bush, as a diversion and a way of pumping up his poll numbers, and the way that the Republican Party and his regime are viewed, that they're going to bomb Iran." And I said, you know, they're never going to do that, because now one of the things that's happened is that Bush has put us in the position of essentially being held hostage by the war in Iraq. Now, what I mean by that, what's his name? Muqtada Sadr, the guy head of the Sadr militia that for a while was fighting U.S. troops. He's a Shiite. He's not a Sunni. A Shiite. Now they have a peace treaty, so to speak, or at least a ceasefire with the American troops there, and he's involved in politics. But he told the president of Iran, because you got to remember, what we have now in power in Iraq is a pro-Iranian Shiite government. And that, I mean, that's what's come of all this. And he said, the Sadr, he said that if the United States or Israel attacks Iran in any way, he will launch an attack on our U.S. forces in Iraq. So I said to my friend, I said, this stalls Bush's hand, pardon me, that he can't do it. And she said, you know, he might do it just to provoke that. And that was, truly frightening. I mean, the idea that war and chaos is what creates, they believe, support for Bush's policies, that they might purposely provoke this assault. Truly threw me for a loop.
Well, I mean, he did the same thing with the war we're in now.
Sure.
I mean, they built up this whole story, blew it way out of proportion, and basically lied to the American people, where they thought, oh my gosh, we got to go do this. And once we got over there and found out all his falsehoods and all his stories, and even the media, some of the newspaper articles you read, support Bush now. And you're thinking, you know, where's all the American people? Why don't we stand up and tell them, hey, enough's enough?
Well, we should, but part of the problem is there's not a lot of ways that we can actually do that. I mean, the Democrats are those weak-kneed, pathetic, that party, barely worthy of the label opposition, is hoping that in November that people will remember all the lies, they'll remember all the incompetence, they'll remember Iraq, they'll remember Katrina, they'll remember eavesdropping, they'll remember all of that, and they'll turn the Bush Congress out and give a Democratic majority in both houses. Now, if you're a dishonest power monger like Bush and his cronies, what would you do in the meantime to turn this around? The only thing I can think of, and the only thing that they've been good at, is throwing fear into the hearts of the American people. So what are they going to do between now and November? I mean, I'm not really trying to pin you down on that, because I don't know myself, but it's frightening to think of it. Hey, listen, you know, I'm going to have to cut you short, because I'm way behind on some business I got to take care of, so I will do this. In the meantime, folks, there's a couple open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Ready to party in paradise with the Poobah?
Back with a heart attack. Celebrating 20 years of Maui Time.
101 Riff and Budweiser are proud to present Maui Time 2006.
The concept!
Ready for some fun in the sun?
How'd you like to spend a week with the sunshine, the crystal blue water, and the black sands of Kahanapali Beach in Maui?
Why don't you tell him the whole story?
And just listen for those three magic words.
Not yet!
Now listen carefully for the directions.
When you hear them, be Motor City Caller 34 on the Rip Line.
And pack your bags, baby.
You and a guest could be getting the hell out of the cold. Partying with Arthur P. and the Rip in Maui. Maui time, 2006.
20 years of Rip. Tradition continues.
The Budweiser. This is Budweiser. This is beer at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Baby!
Or 75 hours of video. Très chic, no? And Henri, don't forget the accessories.
Buy a 30-gig iPod for only $299.99 and get a $15 iTunes card free. And pick up great accessories like an FM transmitter and skins. This Valentine's Day, don't just get a gift, get the right gift at Radio Shack. Offer good 2506 through 21806. Available in select stores. Colors may vary.
Coca-Cola, this is Mitchell.
My friend's brother is a molecular biologist, and he was saying the only way you could have gotten Coke Zero to taste like the regular Coke was to engineer it in space.
I would not.
Well, no, but think about the whole zero factor, like zero gravity. It makes perfect sense.
Zero is for the zero calories.
Just stop pretending that you don't engineer Coke Zero in space. Can you do that?
I wish I could speculate on that, sir.
The next launch. I just want the time for the next launch.
Coca-Cola Zero. Real Coke taste. Zero calories.
Hi, are you the senior flight attendant?
Yes, you must be the new hire. They didn't
tell me you were a
Crunchwrap Supreme.
A what?
A Taco Bell Crunchwrap Supreme.
Have you been a flight attendant before?
Well, no, but it looks easy.
Actually, it's difficult work. You're constantly moving.
Oh, that's perfect, because I'm good to go. I'm all the beefy, melty, crunchy, cool, classic Taco Bell taste you love, made portable.
Great. One bump and you're all over the place.
No, I'm wrapped and grilled in a flour tortilla, completely sealed. I am good to go.
The Crunchwrap Supreme from Taco Bell is back. A crunchy tostada shell, seasoned ground beef, warm nacho cheese sauce, crisp lettuce, juicy tomatoes, and cool sour cream grilled up in a flour tortilla for maximum portability. For classic Taco Bell taste good to go, you've got to think outside the bun. At participating locations. Craving a taste for late-night excitement? Taco Bell is open late so you can feed your need for all the crunchy, spicy, grilled, and melty stuff you crave. Spice up the night. Think outside the bun. Open till 2 a.m. or later. Hours may vary by location.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Some open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see, Jeff writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I don't know if you caught the State of the Union address in its entirety, but what I did catch was George W. saying the same thing to Iran's citizens that he said to Iraq's before we invaded Iraq. I just wonder who's next and what more can go wrong before 2008, provided he is in office until then and actually makes it. Yeah, I don't know. Let's see, more people talking about that fact that Dick Cheney shot his hunting buddy. Robert writes in, what do you think of Uncle Dick wounding his hunting buddy? Shot him with a shotgun. Wonder if the NRA is going to take away his membership. Uncle Dick could kill someone, get away with it. I say charge him with negligence. We'll see. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Reese in Ypsilanti. Reese, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Going great. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah. Hey, so I was just calling to talk about when you were saying what would happen if Syria invaded Iraq, if America did anything with Israel.
Yeah.
And, well, you said that Bush's motives for it were to spread chaos so that people would support him. You don't think that it's possible that he does it to, yes, start a war, but to end it with a peaceful regime? Is it not a good thing to spread democracy?
Well, where is the United States spreading democracy? I mean, the fact that they overthrew this dictator and put into place this ostensibly democratic system at rifle point. Well, we'll see how long it lasts when the American troops are done and when we've spent $1 trillion and we've had 8,000 American dead and 100,000 wounded and, you know, maybe another 100,000 Iraqis killed, right?
Well, yeah, but they were being oppressed and killed anyway. I know that.
Woo, that's terrible, man. I mean, you know, there's international law to stop people from invading countries. I mean, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990, he was in violation of international law that says you can't do that kind of thing. And then the United Nations declared Iraq in violation of the principles. So the United States can't just play the Lone Ranger going down the road deciding what the regime ought to be thrown over. I mean, there's some people that think ours ought to be thrown over. A lot of these Latin American countries think that we're being run by this cabal of rich people that's ripping off the rest of the world and ripping off the United States. You know, I mean, maybe all the armies of Latin America will take it upon themselves to free us from George Bush. I mean, that logic prevails, doesn't it?
It prevails, except for the fact that we're guaranteed by Constitution and principles to be able to do that ourselves, should we so choose. Therefore, in Iraq, they had no method to do that themselves. They had
so you think this was just pure altruism? We were doing it because we were so concerned that these people were being oppressed by Saddam Hussein. I mean, this is the same Saddam Hussein, of course, that was armed the Western countries that Don Rumsfeld went over and shook Saddam's hand. That Saddam Hussein was given all sorts of intelligence by the United States during the Iran-Iraq war. That suddenly he's we just don't like that anymore, right?
Well, it's not that we just don't like it anymore. It's that he invaded a country and used his weapons on his own people, used his torture camps, too.
Well, we know all this. On the other hand, this has turned out to be a disaster. I mean, you're willing to put up the money, right? You're willing to take to date. We've spent a minimum of $204 billion, which is probably way below what it is. That amount of money could have provided health care for the 46 million Americans that don't have health care. We could have hired 3.5 million elementary school teachers. We could have constructed 2 million units of affordable housing. All of that lost in the fog of war. So, I mean, it's real nice that we did it for these people, in your view. But when you really get down to it, it's about one thing, and it's control of oil in the Middle East. I don't know why there's still any doubt about that. Thanks. All right. Let's see. Here is Mark. Mark's listening in Chicago. Mark, hi. It's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us in Detroit on WRIF.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Good. Good, good.
Hey. Did you catch the Russ Feingold speech on the Senate floor?
I did not. Feingold, the senator from Wisconsin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was last week, and it followed the State of the Union, in which Feingold was absolutely shaken and you know, upset over the fact that his fellow congressman stood and cheered a man who was bluntly letting everybody know that he had just broken law and law statute in this country. And if you go to
you're talking about the eavesdropping now.
Yeah.
Well,
he was very blunt in what he said, and the president came up in his State of the Union and said that he authorized the NSA's domestic spying program, and he made a number of misleading arguments in trying to defend himself, and his words got a rousing applause, and Feingold felt ashamed.
Hmm.
And if you want to see the whole transcript, it's on Raw Story. And it's
okay.
An outstanding speech. If you want to hear the last two paragraphs of it, I have it right here. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Summarize it for me.
Well, it's as Democrats, he's saying we do love our freedom, and we will keep we'll fight to keep that freedom. We will fight to defeat terrorists who threaten the safety of our families and loved ones, and we'll fight to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans against intrusive government power. And as the president said, we must always be clear in our principles. So let us be clear. We cherish the great and noble principle of freedom. We will fight to keep it.
Mark, you're reading it.
And
I said summarize. Yeah. But reading, only I read.
Well, I'm sorry. it was an absolutely fantastic speech.
Well, that's good. But
I mean,
one of the things has got to happen is since I don't think we can depend on the Democratic Party to be an opposition party like it should, we've got to reinvent democracy at the base level. And that means creating social movements, because that's all only thing that changed America dramatically throughout our history. Then politicians come running along to catch up and try to be in the forefront of it all. They only move when people move. And what we're facing with now in a society, in the political culture, has become so corrupt that we have people that are only self-serving, and half the time incompetent or crazy. I mean, I think we've got a lot of crazy people making policy. I mean, they attempted to carry out things that they were told over and over again would not work. They were told that if there's an invasion of this nature, that there would be an insurgency. They ignored it. They said if the United States carried out an invasion, an occupation of this nature, that it would precipitate a civil war, and that's come true. So we've got politicians that are ruling us that have no interest in serving the public good to begin with, and appear to be incapable even on non-political issues, say like around Katrina, that they're either venal or incompetent. And the Democratic Party dithers. That means either we create mass movements of opposition and resistance, or we're just going to have to. We get maybe another terrorist attack, maybe another attack on another country, maybe an economy that works more and more for the elite and less for the middle class and the working class. All right, Mark. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joe. Joe's in what's the name of your city here, Joe? Duran.
Duran, Michigan.
Duran, isn't
Wanta County?
Isn't that a didn't they name an English pop group after your city, except double it up? Duran Duran.
Yeah, not quite, Peter. It used to be a home to the drive-in that showed dirty movies way back when. They used to call it the Duran Dirties.
Really?
Yeah, way back when, a long time before I moved out there.
What's up with you, Joe?
Not much. Just got back last week from the National CAF Conference for the UAW.
Oh, yeah, I used to broadcast from those every once in a while. The Community Act, what is it, Community Action Program?
Yep.
Yeah, Community. The UAW stalwarts assemble in D.C. for learn organizing skills and political skills, right?
Yep, and we go up, you know, basically try and create a small section of a movement. You go up, you see your reps, you know, you walk around, you wear union colors, you know, you get on all the cameras, you know, all the little security cameras downtown and stuff, and, you know, you try and impress upon them what we could be.
Uh-huh.
You know, as you talk about social movements and trying to do something, that's one of the things I really, really saw out of all the things they talked about there. It's the fact that once we made politicians come to us, we did things, they came to us, they respected us, they feared us. Now all they fear is that the union might wake up one day and actually show up.
Yeah, and well, that's why always Democratic candidates for president would always speak at in downtown Detroit on Labor Day. So, I don't know, maybe the last one to do it was John Kennedy. But that was way back in the day.
Well, that's back before we, you know, before we started losing everything, before it all started going downhill. But what people don't realize out there is if the unions can get strong, if people can show up for meetings, we get membership to show up, we can create the things we need to happen. But
yeah,
we can't get membership any longer.
No, I know. I mean, I don't have any bright ideas. I mean, my union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, after us, AFL-CIO, I mean, we're taking hit after hit, and it's a kind of a long story and not really maybe the proper venue here to discuss why, but it's scary. It's scary because I mean, the employers see the ability to drive down our wages that our fathers and grandfathers fought to, and grandmothers and mothers and grandmothers as well, fought to establish a middle-class standard of living, and it's beginning to erode. And among the middle class, you see layoff after layoff after layoff, people being forced to work more and more, you know, harder and harder, and still, we say, well, the economy's doing well. Just look at the Dow Jones average. I don't think that's where really where to look, though. All right, yeah, go CAP. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Pardon me. Let's go to James in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Again, open lines 313-298-WRIF. Hi, James.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing great.
I got two things I'd like to touch on. One is in response to some of the callers who seem to be defending the war in Iraq using a lot of the same old canards like Saddam was so evil and so on. I just finished reading Robert Fisk's book, The Great War for Civilization.
Oh, yeah.
And Fisk is being one of the few unembedded Western reporters covering the Iraq war, along with like Patrick Colburn and a couple others. This book, I challenge these people to read this book, and it's well over 1,000 pages, so if not read the entire book, read the last four chapters and then try to defend the war using that same reasoning that we heard tonight. The book, he describes what he saw in Baghdad in such excruciating detail, it'll make you sick to your stomach or make you cry or both. And then after that, there's no defense for what we've done.
Well, you know, James, I think books like that are extraordinarily important to read and to you know, to understand the mechanisms through which we were lied to and how our emotions, our fears, our angers, all of that were played upon. However, I'm beginning to think that it's on shows like this of attempting to convince those last holdouts that still believe these fictions that the Bush administration peddles, or peddled even, is kind of a waste of time. I'm not even, it's not even generating lots of calls. I mean, this is kind of unusual.
Uh-huh.
Usually we're just stuck. And I'm not, by the way, I think I'm really glad you called. I'm really glad you pointed out this book, because I think it's important that people don't get fooled for the next war that the Bushies have planned.
Well, that ties into a second point, if I may. Going to the State of the Union address, and I'm just going to, okay, one sentence I'm going to read to you. From the State of the Union, Bush said, "Our own generation is in a long war against a determined enemy, a war that will be fought by presidents of both parties who will need steady bipartisan support from the Congress, and tonight I ask for yours." If it's going to be fought by presidents of both parties, just how long into the future is Bush and the neocon cabal projecting this so-called war on terror? There isn't a matter of the next war. It's a matter of the continuing war, according to Bush in his own State of the Union address. Now, how you can support that as the future of the country is beyond my understanding.
Well, we're in a permanent war economy, and this is a permanent war state. The United States never got out of the Depression of the 30s until the first quarter of 1942, when we had gone on to a full-time war economy to fight the Germans and the Japanese. And when the Second World War was over, there was great fear in the ruling circles that peace would break out. We had to invent another enemy. The Soviets having won the war in Europe against the Nazis, the Red Army, and also being devastated by the war, wanted cooperation with the West, and it was the United States, England particularly, that initiated a Cold War that would necessitate a permanent war economy. We've been on that ever since. And what it essentially is this incredible transfer of private wealth, yours and mine, what we earn, and then a portion of it in taxes is taken to the government, and then rather than return to us as public services, so we could have this wonderful country without poverty, without disease, and a world too, but I mean, to speak selfishly, our borders, and have this country reflect the wealth that it has. This wealth is transferred to these war industries, and that's the basis of our economy.
But it's not something that we have to accept.
I agree.
Still chance that we can wake up enough to understand that the way the economy is being manipulated and the social classes are being manipulated and pared down to A, the wealthy, B, the military.
Yeah.
And with very little in between. And if we want to accept that and accept the continual sacrifice of lives, of our lives, rather than investing in the future, then, that's again, it's beyond my understanding. And on shows like this, please, people out there, read, investigate, find out. It's your money, it's your future, it's your kids, it's your life.
That's absolutely true. The problem is what we have to invent is the mechanism, the agency, the whatever, the device through which we can create another world rather than the one that is in such tatters and appears to be on the verge of getting worse. All right, I got to move along for my top of the hour business. Thank you, James, for calling in from Kenosha. And open lines for you. I'm going to introduce something else. You aren't responding to this very much, but I'm going to talk about our pocketbooks a little, and also some stuff about college, what it's going to cost us, but also what's happening inside of the halls of learning. Be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF. WRIF
reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wri.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Chili Hotline.
This is hard to talk about.
You're among chili lovers. Go ahead.
Well, I tried a new chili the other day, and it was, well, soupy.
Ooh, well, I can tell you what it wasn't. It wasn't Stag chili, right?
Right.
Love and learn. At Stag Foods, chili is all they do. No soups, no juice, no cookies.
I'm in love.
Stag chili. The chili chili lovers love.
The following is a list of hazardous or cancer-causing substances and where they might be found. Hydrazine, found in rocket fuel. Carbon monoxide, found in automobile exhaust. Acetone, found in nail polish remover. Cadmium, found in batteries. Formaldehyde, found in embalming fluid. Methanol, found in windshield wiper fluid. And hydrogen cyanide, found in rat poison. The following is a list of where you'll find all these chemicals in one single place. Cigarette smoke.
You found truth on your FM dial.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second segment at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. And I say that because I know lots of you are listening all around the country, some of you all around the world. We'll be airing two interviews. Let me see if my brain works. I could actually cheat and write it down, and then I would know who. Oh, yeah, this kind of works. Noel Sulla, who is the president of the board of directors of ACCESS. That's the Arab Community Service Organization in Dearborn. He's going to talk about immigration, about the cartoons that are offending so many Muslims. And let's see. Oh, yeah, then we're going to talk about the Bush budget at a little, maybe like 1:30 or something like that. Bush proposed this $2.77 trillion budget that's cutting like Medicare and education. I mean, it's going to affect elderly people negatively. It's kicking people off medical rolls so we can continue to give tax breaks to the ultra wealthy, if you can imagine that. More and more billions, $70 billion he wants for emergency funds for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these tax breaks, so far, let's see, total war spending for 2006 is $120 billion, plus $70 billion in emergency funds, in addition to the $50 billion. Oh, that's it, $70 billion in emergency funds, $50 billion that Congress has already approved. Grants for safe and drug-free schools, gone. Vocational education, gone. Reading programs for jailed young people, gone. Let's see. Many of the programs proposed for elimination have an emotional pull, like one providing $170 million for food for the elderly poor. Gone! These rich son of a bitches that run our world and run our country are taking food out of the mouths of the elderly poor that can't help themselves. Remember family values? What a load of crap these people put forth. I mean, they're the biggest hypocrites that ever hit the face of the earth. And, I mean, to call them hypocrites is such, I mean, it's just a weak word. You don't care about any of that? How about you're going to college? Well, how about this? The average cost of a yearly tuition at a four-year public university in 2000, when Clinton was the president, was $7,000. The average cost of yearly tuition at a four-year public university last year, 2000, almost $11,000. So it's gone up $4,000. Average increase in yearly tuition costs for public university students, about $4,000. Average loan burden carried by a student upon graduation of 2003, about $19,000. On and on and on like that. If this is overwhelming you with figures, it means that because we don't properly respond in a powerful manner, we're going to be ripped off. And we're being ripped off, whether it's at the pump, whether it's in our jobs, working more, getting paid less, medical costs being passed on to us, on and on and on. And you say, well, what's the proper response? What do I do? How can I do this? I want to do something. I was over at this what do they call it? I can't remember. Like, I'll call it, for lack of a better word, special high school in Oak Park called CASA. I can't remember. Someone that knows about this, call me and remind me what this stands for and what the school's all about. 313-298-WRIF. And speaking was Bill Ayers, who years ago, a generation ago, was in something called the Weather Underground. Now he's a professor of education in Illinois. But he was urging these young people, 16, 17, 18 years old, to get involved in things, just like I'm doing. The only problem is there wasn't a way that any one of those kids could walk out the door and get involved in anything. That those forms of resistance to the attack on our standard of living, to living in an economy based on war, both economically and actually making war, just aren't immediately available. I mean, there are demonstrations. I go to them. Not enough of you go to them. There's going to be a big one in New York on April 29th, probably have a million people out there. Anyways, Michigan students are going to have to pay another $1,600 more for college loans since Congress has passed this measure to cut spending, according to this new report called Campaign for America's Future. On and on and on. I mean, there are things in here, let's see. Oh, yeah. Bush has also taken out this lump sum that goes to widows and widowers upon deaths. The budget Bush submitted to Congress proposes eliminating a $255 lump sum death benefit that has been part of Social Security for more than 50 years. And when someone like your grandparents die, and they get $255, and Bush is cutting that out because he wants to save a little bit of money, because he can't give these tax breaks to the wealthy and at the same time afford any programs for us. Let's see. Yeah, cutting $12 billion in student loan subsidies. Let's see here. New spending to extend an income subsidy program for dairy farmers, giving them $1 billion. Got to do that. Measure aims to trim $39 billion out of the budget over 5 years, partly through cuts in Medicaid, Medicare, and student loan subsidies. This is absolutely amazing. These people, besides just being greedy, are heartless. I guess that comes together, doesn't it? All right, 313-298-WRIF. Suddenly all of you want to talk about this stuff. All right, we'll see. Here's Steve in Ferndale. Steve, hey, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing, Pete?
Doing great.
I was just curious. We're in quite a quagmire out in the Middle East there, and we're probably in too big of a hole to really get ourselves out of without causing more damage. But I was also wondering, aside from us being there, for the oil and all that kind of stuff, do you also think that perhaps we went there because we want to have a permanent military presence in the Middle East?
Well, sure. That's another part of it. I mean, the reason we want to have a military presence in the Middle East, though, is so we can control oil in the Middle East. And also, it continues the slop bucket for military spending, of which you and I pay so handsomely and get so little back from. Essentially what it does, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars, we've probably spent trillions of dollars, in order to guarantee profits to the oil companies, which now we know are making these record profits like ExxonMobil and Chevron. But we've intervened in the Middle East for the last 50 or 60 years in order to guarantee the flow of oil and, more importantly, oil profits, rather than a long time ago realizing this is untenable, making great strain, great efforts at conservation, more fuel-efficient cars, and alternative energy. They figure, well, wait, we got all these suckers, you and me, willing to pay the bill to make sure that ExxonMobil continues its profits, so why get off oil?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, also, do you really think it would be wise for us to let the government in Iran develop a nuclear bomb?
Well, I don't think anybody should have a nuclear bomb, including the United States. And one of the things that that Bush could do would be to create a situation, like I said earlier, of declaring peace. One of the reasons that Iran, if in fact it is attempting to develop nuclear weapons, which wouldn't particularly surprise me, is to forestall either an Israeli or United States attack upon it. Because it knows, and I've said this any number of times, that if you don't have weapons of mass destruction, like Bushko knew Iraq didn't, then you get invaded. If you have nuclear weapons like North Korea, then Bush is over there saying, hey, can we make a deal? How about if we give you some aid? We'll set you up with nuclear power. We'll give you food and all of that. So Bush, since he heads the most powerful country in the world with no opponents, should be leading the drive for nuclear disarmament and also assuring all countries of the world that it will not be invaded. Iran is a democracy. It elects its officials. It doesn't need the irrationalization of overthrowing a dictator doesn't hold there, for one thing. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Jim in Toronto. Jim, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
All right. I was wondering what you thought about the article, Granholm isn't blamed for job woes in Michigan.
What? Are you from Michigan and just visiting there or what?
No, but I read the Detroit News online.
Well, I don't think that Granholm is responsible for the job loss. That's pretty clear. What do you think about it?
Well, you can't just blame it. There's always, more than just one person to blame. You know, I think it's collective. It's a collective agreement. I don't think she's putting up much of a fight, and I just think you know what I'm saying?
Well, I don't have any interest in, defending Governor Granholm. However, that when you have a situation where the industrial base is allowed to flee from good, decent wages and being able to allowed to produce parts in other parts of the world where they don't have to pay the same sort of labor costs, when you have a situation where corporations figure out that they can blackmail their employees into working harder and essentially taking pay cuts through having to pay more and more for their medical costs and downsizing continually. Well, that's not the fault of one governor. It's not a hell of a lot she could do. It's a way that an economic system works where people are an afterthought. Profits rule, money rules, people are secondary considerations. All right, hey, thanks for making our program international, Jim. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. And here's Jeff in Detroit. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I haven't talked to you in a while. How you doing?
Good. You're Jeff from Detroit Rock City. I thought you mean your shop in Warren, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, how you doing?
I've learned a lot in the last year, I'll tell you that, Peter.
Have you ever recovered from the Kerry's loss to Bush? I know you were very active in the campaign.
Well, I was very desperate for anybody but Bush to take over, but I've since learned that it wouldn't have made much difference if Kerry had gotten in there anyway, but... It's what I wanted to talk to you about is there's so many things I want to tell you that I've learned over the last year about, you know, what's going on and nobody else in your audience really understands, especially about finance, about their money and how the fact that the Federal Reserve is a privately owned bank for profit.
Yeah.
They loan our money to the government for us to use.
Well, I mean, hey, Jeff, don't go down this road of the money nuts. The fact that the Federal Reserve is part of the functioning of the way that, monetary policy. It doesn't have independent policies of its own for the benefit of any differently than the whole apparatus of the system. I mean, people start getting into this abolish the Federal Reserve. It's just nuts.
Well, Peter, you've got to see with the information that I've come across.
I've seen all of it.
You've seen all of it?
It's standard stuff of the right wing. It's really not worth the...
We're talking about facts. Carol Quigley exposed it all in a book in the 1960s. Clinton was one of his students, for Christ's sake.
Who did? Who exposed it?
Carol Quigley wrote a book.
Oh, yeah.
It exposes everything. It's verified. It's been.
I know, but the whole idea—if we stayed on the gold standard and all that—I mean, it's a total diversion from understanding how power is exercised in this country on behalf of wealth. I mean, if the Federal Reserve is part of the apparatus that does that, or one of the mechanisms of the apparatus, it's just one little part. I mean, what we have to do is how are the people empowered with our ability, and I would say our right, to make the fundamental decisions that affect us rather than these elites? So if they abolished the Federal Reserve system tomorrow, they would just have another way of controlling monetary policy as long as we're just sitting back and doing nothing.
Granted, it's not the whole reason, but it is a large chunk of the pie.
Nah, it's not not a big chunk of the pie.
Yes, it is.
What's okay. No, it's not. Yes, it is. We're not going to get very far with that. Thanks, Jeff. Let's see here. This is Craig in Barrie, Ontario, right?
Yes. How's it going, Peter?
Where did we stay? Is that up by Georgian? No, not by Georgian Bay, or is it?
Yeah, it is. Just north of Toronto. It's where the Live 8 concert was held in Canada.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us.
Excellent. Glad. First-time caller. I've actually sent you a few emails. We've chatted a few times like that.
Okay.
I just actually want to see what your thoughts were. I'm not sure if you guys have touched base on this or not yet tonight, but the rash of violence that's sweeping the world in wake of the cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, I mean, I have lots of thoughts. Why don't you start it off by giving me yours?
Well, I mean, from what I've been able to gather from it, I can definitely see how the
cartoons are distasteful and can be seen as offensive, but at the same time, like, this is not the way to deal with it, people. Like, violence begets violence, and all that's going to happen is the violence will escalate with this. We've got all these Muslim leaders stating that it's a religion of peace and tolerance, so, like, please start showing us these images so we can, like, prove these caricatures wrong rather than supporting the images that they display.
Well, I mean, I think that the interview that's coming up at 1 a.m. is instructive with Noel Salah with the Arab community. I can't remember all of it, but it spells out access. It's this extraordinarily wonderful community resource in Dearborn that doesn't work just for Arab Americans, but for people all around our city. But the idea that, I mean, well, one of the things that Noel and I talk about in this recorded interview is when, Timothy McVeigh blew up the FBI bill or the federal building in Oklahoma City. Nobody asked white men to disassociate themselves from that. No one, when these right-wing Christian militias or whatever exist, no one asked you and me to separate ourselves from them. I mean, lumping together, I mean, the majority of Muslims, I'm sure, across the world, the vast majority of them don't react like this. And they have been condemned by all sorts of Muslim leaders. But on the other hand, it's manipulated by a lot of these regimes. They figure, yeah, good, we'll get them real mad at Denmark and Israel and the United States, and then they won't mess with us.
Oh, I completely agree with what you're saying. I think that it's ridiculous that these extremists are giving, like, the entire Arab community such a bad name. No different than I think especially you see it, fortunately for us up here in Canada, a little more in the States, but I mean, I consider Bush to be a Christian extremist. But
on the other hand, he doesn't influence the way people see other Christians. And like I said, I mean, does Timothy McVeigh reflect badly on all white men? I mean, why should some Muslims do as a group or as individuals have any effect on the way we see all of them?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
The other point I just actually wanted to question on was something that I caught in the Canadian media, is that there's actually Muslim leaders in Montreal here that are calling for the Canadian government to deem anything like this in the future as a hate crime.
Well, actually, a lot of countries, including Canada, do not permit speech to the extent that we do here in the States, right?
Oh, exactly, and I'm very fortunate. I think we're very fortunate for that. I did have a time to work for Canada Customs, and we were actually instructed, it was at the Windsor-Detroit Tunnel, to look for any literature that may be coming in that could be deemed as hate literature, because it is illegal here in Canada.
Yeah, and it is produced here in the United States. Anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-Arab, all sorts of the really awful stuff, some of it right from the Detroit area, as a matter of fact. And yeah, there's a lot of countries where there is a statutory limit to speech and publishing.
Exactly, which I think done in some cases it may be seen as censorship, but in other cases, like, we have been fortunate enough that there have been no papers here in Canada to would even consider picking up and reprinting this cartoon, because they'd probably be in a bit of hot water with the local authorities.
Well, I'll tell you, Craig, being a broadcaster and being a writer, censorship really scares me. I mean, one thing I would say, and I can't remember, I don't have the interview in front of me, that this one Arab writer says that you don't have to say everything you have the right to. In other words, there's lots of, in fact, speech stops at what they call fighting words. I mean, I have the right to say a lot of things, but if I say it to people's face, that on they might engender a violent response. And so, but all of that is very tricky, because I don't trust governments in order to protect my right to express myself. And we've done all right. I don't know. I mean, what's shameful is that there is a market for hate literature. Not that a few wackos bother to take it upon themselves to write diatribes against people that have tenuous similarities, you know, like the groups that always wind up to be the focus of hate groups. But the fact that there are so many people, or not, there's not that many people, but there's enough people that that wanna buy that stuff. That's what's really a problem. All right, I got to move on. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. It's great talking to you, Peter.
Thank you so much for calling from Barrie, Ontario. Some open lines, 313-298-WRIF. So, I mean, here's what I think. When someone is trying to stop speech, and in this case, publication of these cartoons, it makes me want to say, yeah, put it on the cover of every single publication in the world. And on the other hand, I'm thinking, why do I want to piss people off? And on the other hand, why do I want to create the tumult that already has? In other words, I work with papers, and if someone said, if we were the paper that was approached and said, well, you want to run all these cartoons that lampoon Muhammad, I'd say, you know, that's probably not a good idea. They're pretty upset about the way the West has been interacting with them for the last 100 years or so. And why piss these people off all the more, right? And so I probably would say no, I'm not going to do it. But then I'd think, well, am I self-censoring? Yeah, I am. But, I mean, what's to be lost by not doing this? Well, there are some things to be lost. Well, you can tell I'm kind of going both ways on this. All right, let's go to Joseph in Vegas. Is this like Las Vegas or Vegas, Michigan?
Las Vegas.
Oh, all right, welcome.
How's it going?
It's going great.
Peter, I'd like to preface my discussion with the fact that I'm an African-American male, and I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Okay.
I've lived in Vegas for the past 3.5 years, and I'm wondering about these people who call with their support for the president and his war, to the tune of what is it, $2.5 billion a week that we're spending there,
something like that. $100,000 an hour.
Yeah. Right, right. So I'm wondering, why is it that the city of New Orleans gets, from what I understand, $6.2 billion?
Yeah.
I mean, in total, and I something just doesn't set right with me regarding this. And these people, they don't tend to look at the big picture as to how many people are making so much money off of this, and our nation is going broke. I mean, absolutely broke. And I've come to the conclusion that one of two things is happening. Either Bush is lying to us about the rationale and the whole reasoning for the war, or we're getting our rears handed to us by a group of a few thousand guys wearing sandals using 15- and 20-year-old firearms.
Yeah. Yeah, well, which makes more sense?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like one of these people to call in with a concrete something. I need something. I need them to stop saying, oh, you know, Saddam was a bad guy. I need more than that, because there are a lot of bad guys out there, Peter.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Joseph, that I've given up. I mean, I think that the hardcore Bush supporters, the hardcore war supporters, there's not a thing in the world you could tell them. You could have a recording of Bush and Cheney and them, Rumsfeld, saying, look, we know he doesn't have any weapons of mass destruction, but we want to get that oil.
Right.
They would still say, no, well, they, you know, the reason they said that was because, you ever heard that someone, well, people say to me sometimes, what would you say to a person if they said blah, 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 and I said, I'd probably say goodbye.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I am with
right.
a lot of those folks. But getting back to rebuilding New Orleans, it's shameful what's happening, and it, right. and as you know, it's not just New Orleans, it's the, you know, Alabama and Mississippi cities, yeah, the entire Gulf Coast, that people don't have adequate housing. There's a diaspora, in other words, people dispersed to 44 states. I think it's with great intent that a lot of people, particularly African Americans, particularly poor African Americans, that ain't going to make it back.
Oh, exactly.
That's one of the intents. So rather than taking care of our own, taking care of ourselves, We're transferring our tax dollars, which I could see going to rebuild an American city. We're going to be rebuilding. Well, that's fallen flat on his face. I was going to say, right, to rebuild Iraq that we destroyed. That has not happened.
It absolutely has fallen on its face, and the media hasn't addressed it to whereas the masses of Americans know this.
Yeah, well, you know, we've caught on to almost everything else. It's just a shame that it happens so slowly. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in from Las Vegas. The old comedian Lenny Bruce used to call it Lost Wages. Yeah. Let's take another call before the break. It's John from Wyandotte. Hey, John. It's Peter Werby on WRIF.
Welcome. Hey, what's going on, Peter?
Hi.
On the point about the cartoon and the newspaper and the whole reaction to it, you know, I agree with you on the point that censorship is very scary. You know, I may not agree with everything that you say on there, but you have the right to say it, and I fully support that. At what point it's something that offends a race or religion of people to your statements about the president are offensive to one or two people, and you're no longer allowed to say it?
Yeah.
You know, on that point, you know, censorship is very scary. Once you start letting it go, it's that much more they take away from you. Patriot Act is a perfect example.
Yeah, I was thinking, John, historically, the pastor of the Shrine of the Little Flower Church in Royal Oak, Michigan, Father Coughlin, who during the late 1930s gave these virulent anti-Semitic, anti-black, pro-Nazi speeches. And he was his speech was protected up until the war, and then he was shut down, that he was not allowed to broadcast anymore. And people like Coughlin and people, there's all sorts of people like him throughout American history that have been toxic to trying to create a country that we're at internally at peace with one another. And what do we do? Because you're right. If you say, all right, we're shutting down Father Coughlin, well, we'll be creating chaos too, criticizing the officials, saying that our government's a racket, that the war is a lie, that Bush is only out to give more money to the wealthy, that he failed us at Katrina. Doesn't that just erode confidence in the government and all of that? So it's a slippery slope. I don't know where to go with it. All right, John, thank you very much. I got to take a break. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy at the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Yep, we got one more commercial, though. Hold on.
This Valentine's Day, experience the romance, the sizzle, the style, the passion of Chris Bode. Don't miss the hottest young trumpet player on the scene. It's a Chris Bode Valentine, one night only, Tuesday, February 14th at the Max. His sultry sound is synonymous with passion and romance. Now, you too can experience Chris Bode in a sizzling live performance, featuring his hits Back Into My Heart, No Ordinary Love, and more. Treat yourself to a Valentine's Day you won't forget. It's a Chris Bode Valentine, one night only, Tuesday, February 14th in Orchestra Hall. Tickets to this one night only event are going fast. Reserve yours today at 313-576-5111. That's 313-576-5111 or at DetroitSymphony.com.
All right, we're back on WRIF in Detroit. 313-298-WRIF. We're in our last segment. And let me see here if I can find out who's our next caller. Can't do it. We'll get the person who's been waiting the longest. Reverend James from Sterling Heights. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great, thanks.
You know what I get a kick out of is we're trying to bring democracy to Iraq, and you can't even drive into Detroit and feel safe. Huh. You got 3,000 killings in Detroit every year.
You think there's 3,000
killings? Oh, easy. Easy. Last year, one of the councilwomen out there begged for the militia to come out, and she said, I'm sorry, we've lied to you all these years about the crime rate. It's worse than we told you. Please bring the military. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember it, but Reverend James, there's not 3,000 people killed in Detroit every year.
Anyway, the bottom line is we're spending our money all around the world, and our cities and our own country are dying.
Yeah.
They're dead. But I didn't call to tell you about problems. I'd like to give people a quick solution real fast. If you want to own Washington, D.C., you have to understand Washington, D.C., both Democratic and Republican, is owned by corporate America. Ralph Nader will tell you what I'm telling you, and George Perot, Ross Perot, 20 years ago told you this when he ran for election.
Sure.
And they threatened to kill his daughter. He said America's no more than a banana republic with nuclear weapons. He tried to run for election. He backed out. I don't know if you remember that. And the reason he backed out of the running for election in third party is because they threatened to kill his daughter.
Huh.
Do you remember that?
I actually don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, that was years ago. The big-eared guy. Everybody made fun of his ears. They didn't care about what he had to say.
Oh, yeah, Perot. I remember him. I was just talking about Nader.
Everybody makes fun of his ears. Everybody makes fun of Ralph Nader. But the guy tells you the truth. If you want to own Washington, D.C., you have to control the flow of money that goes into the corporations. If you own the corporations, you own you own Washington, D.C.
And control also the amount of money that the corporations pump into the politicians. All right, Reverend James, thank you. Here's Bill in Southfield. Bill, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello. This is Bill here, and I wanted to make a comment
about this guy that called in earlier that said his brother, I think it was, that was over in Iraq, and he said they only have like 20 people who can do what his brother did. And I wanted to say, well, see, that's the problem. They're got all these people with specialized jobs that they don't have enough people to get the job done.
Right.
And then you have a certain amount of people get killed off, and then you have, you know, half as many. And see, I was just wondering, how do they expect to win a war when you don't have, you know, the proper troops? I called last week and kind of said the same thing, and now this guy's saying that, well, they only have 20 people who can do this job, and that's kind of discouraging.
No, I wonder,
you know, when they don't have,
yeah, with all due respect to him, I wonder if that, in fact, is correct. I mean, is there actually a job classification in the military that there's only 20 people? I mean, they have that stop-loss program or order or whatever you'd call it, that when your tour is done, they can actually hold you in the military because they say that your position is crucial. But they've been doing that more just for the troops in general. But I don't know. I don't know if maybe we need some people, Bill, to tell us whether or not there are some. Remember he said he was like a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, 20 of them in Iraq? I don't know. It seems like it should be more than that. All right, thanks. Anybody know the answer to that one? There's got to be more than 20 helicopter pilots in Iraq, isn't there? 313-298-WRIF. You were there or know the answer, give us a shout. Here's Eric in Walled Lake. Eric, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hey, man.
Hey, man.
Hi.
Hey, I want to justify a couple things. I want to try to justify what that one guy from Las Vegas. He said something about Bush. Why is he still in Iraq?
Yeah.
I think I have a sound theory, but keep in mind it's a theory. Like, you know, we have a base in Okinawa. We have a base. We have a couple bases in Japan. We have a base in Korea. That's all to babysit the rest of the world where our threats are. Now we need another babysitter over in the Middle East now. So that's my sound theory. That's only good, like a good half of what I'm thinking about, you know?
Well, I think the important thing, Eric, as I said, is how do we disengage from this adversary role in the world? You might say there's people that are always going to be looking for trouble or always taking advantage of other countries or always trying to repress people, but I don't think we've been going at it in a 21st century way. I mean, the United States has the military clout and, well, does it? I mean, we can't seem to win the war in Iraq. But, I mean, overall, military and economic clout that we ought to be able to accomplish a little more. Or it's just all hopeless. Or, you know, it's one of these days everything is going to explode as more and more countries develop nuclear weapons. Already we have these situations in South Asia with India and Pakistan with nuclear weapons that have already threatened each other with them. Pakistan is probably a hair's breadth away from having a fundamentalist Muslim regime if this dictator, I mean, we're all for democratic rights, right? Except we have this dictator in power in Pakistan. So something innovative has to be done. In fact, Stevie Wonder, I don't know if you saw that at the beginning of the at the Super Bowl, you know, the pregame. Did you see that with Stevie Wonder where at the end he said either we got to solve all these problems or we're going to annihilate ourselves?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's more true perhaps than it was during the Cold War, although that oftentimes looked pretty dicey. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. And, I mean, we have the power. We don't have the power to do what we're trying to do. I mean, it keeps being failed policy. So how do we make peace with the world? And I don't know. Maybe it's too late at night for me to just start saying this is the way we could do it because, you know, who am I? I'm just another guy with an opinion like you. But one of the things that we have to do is we have to get this ultimate decision-making power out of these elites, and particularly these elites with that are rooted in policies that never worked ever, that just created war after war after war, and appear to have every capacity to continue this until something really awful happens. That, so you think, well, you know, people say, well, we can't make peace with the Arabs. They're crazy. Right? Well, we made peace with lots of them. You know, we have peace with Saudi Arabia. We have peace with Jordan. We have peace with Egypt and what have you. The reason that there's not peace in the Middle East, well, there's lots of reasons. One of it is we've been mucking around in their affairs for too long. We've been overthrowing governments. We support dictatorship still. I mean, we give billions of dollars a year to Egypt, which essentially is a dictatorship as well, and represses people. Why don't we go in there and take him out? Well, because he, Mubarak, supports our efforts in the Middle East. That's very simple. So we're essentially, again, this is this transfer of private wealth, yours and mine, what we produce. It's given to the government, and rather than it coming back in the form of services or even goods to us. I mean, the government could do this. Government needs a certain amount of money to operate, but also what it does, it can act as a clearinghouse to take money into the general fund and allocate it in a manner that is beneficial to all of us. All right? However, what it does, it takes this money and then it either throws it down the rat hole of war and preparations for war, or it gives it away to governments like in the Middle East. Who's getting it over there? Is anybody getting it? You know what? There's so many damn governments over there getting it. It's not just Israel and Egypt and Jordan, but it's those little emirates as well. We got bases over there, and it props them up. And that's what happens to our money. A lot of it comes back, of course, for the war industries, because we give them money and then they buy jet planes from us. Why do they want jet planes? Who are they going to fight? Who's Egypt going to fight? Who's Jordan going to fight? Why do they have armed forces of the extent that that they do? I mean, one of the things would be nice would be a de-escalation of everything that is spent on armaments. The world now spends about $1 trillion on armaments a year. Half of that by the United States. Because we have all these mighty enemies to protect ourselves against, right? Like, who? Who's spending all this money? Well, China's spending about 10% of that. They spend about $50 billion. And then it drops precipitously down. I mean, I don't even know why countries, for instance, like Mexico or Canada, even have armies. Why do they even have an army? They don't need one. That's so 20th century and 19th century and 18th century and 14th century. It didn't work then, and it's going to get worse in the 21st century because of the technological capacity we have. All right, let's continue on. Get these as we go towards the end of the program. Let's get all of you on. Andrew in Oxford. Andrew, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had a question. Everyone has talked about this being like a war for oil, but when I look around, gas is like $2.50 a gallon.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how it's a war for oil. I was just wondering if you had any more insight on that. And I also had a question on what you thought was going to happen as more like fuel efficient cars are produced and we start using alternative fuels. What do you think that's going to do to the Middle East?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's not a great effort to do the latter. Well, you mean, boy, if we're going to have, if we went to war to get all this oil, why haven't we then just driven the price down? Well, for one thing, we're being gouged at the pump by these big oil giants who are making record profits when there's no need to. But I just came back from Venezuela, and gasoline there is 14 cents a gallon. That's what they do with the oil that they pump. And in Iraq, by the way, I think it's about the same thing. I think it's 10 or 15 cents a gallon. It wasn't, you know, the war wasn't fought so the United States could get oil into our refineries, which, as it is, there's not enough refinery capacity, because one of the ways that these companies artificially pumped up the price of oil was they purposely limited refinery capacity. So there wouldn't be. There'd be shortages, and they could justify driving up the price. But it's for control of oil. It's not to get oil. It's to control oil. And it's one of the things, it hasn't worked out well for Bush. It's been a disaster. Right? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Mike in Windsor. A lot of people from Canada tonight. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question. I've been hearing a lot. The president's going to be releasing 12 hours of tape, phone calls with Saddam or something of that nature, talking about WMDs. What do you think the left's going to have to say if there actually is talk of them?
I haven't heard anything about it, but like I said, that there would have been a real easy way. I say this once a program. The United Nations mandated weapons inspectors had to be allowed into Iraq in 2003 at the beginning of the year, then, or they would declare Iraq to be in material violation of the resolutions that ended the first Gulf War. Saddam let them in. They found absolutely no weapons. Bush said, we got to go to war, because he knew there were no weapons. I don't know what Saddam was saying, or why he, you know, why he was doing what he was doing, or what kind of cards he was playing. But Bush knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and the weapons were not found by the inspectors. And if they would have waited 30 days, they would have found that there were absolutely no weapons. And if Saddam would have been weakened to the extent that he would, that his because so much depended on personality there, it's very possible that there would have been an internal revolt against Saddam Hussein. And now these people, you know, the number of people that have died and been wounded up into the hundreds of thousands, and now probably never would have been necessary. That's what I think. All right, thank you very much. Let's see, here is Charles in Sterling Heights. Charles, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing today?
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah, I just had quite a few comments about you and your callers.
Yeah.
Well, that one guy from Las Vegas, and he was saying, you know, why do we have that war over there in Iraq?
Uh-huh.
Well, the reason is because we're going to have to fight these people, because half the people we're fighting over there in Iraq aren't even Iraqis. They're from all over the Middle East.
You know? Well, there's not very many of them, actually. They represent about 10%. Who are these people? What are these people?
The terrorists.
Well, there's not very many terrorists in the world.
Oh, there's not? That's why...
How many do you think there are in absolute numbers?
I'm not sure exactly.
Well, I mean, do you think there's 1,000 or 1 million?
I don't put out left communist propaganda that I don't know.
Well, what does that mean, Charles?
What do you think that means?
I don't know. You're talking like a crazy man. Come on, make some sense for us. Now tell me, how many terrorists do you think there are in Iraq? I mean, if you're going to make these declarative statements, you should have some facts. How many terrorists do you think are there?
I don't know. There's a lot. People are getting killed every day.
Well, what's the difference between a terrorist or an insurgent? You know, the British thought that Lighthouse Harry Lee, who fought guerrilla warfare in Virginia, they called him a terrorist, and they thought he was, because he was resisting the royal rule.
No. You don't understand here, man.
What don't I understand?
I don't know. You're spreading propaganda that you don't even know about.
Wait a minute, Charles. It sounds more like you don't know what you're talking about. Now, you made some statements, and you've got to back them up with some facts. You said that we're going to have to fight them. I said, who are them? You said that they were terrorists. I said, how many are there? You said, you don't know. Well, maybe there's only 100, so we don't have to worry about it that much. If there's 1 million, we'd have to really worry about it. But I suggest that you read a little, figure this all out, don't call names, and maybe call back next week. All right, thank you. Yay. All right, here's Rich in Wayne. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Doing good.
I got a couple of subjects I want to tackle. The first one being the whole Jin thing. I honestly think that it's kind of just a bit of an overreaction. Online and everything, I haven't been able to find the content of these cartoons. But for a cartoon for the people to burn on embassies, it just seems a little much.
Well, on the face of it, it does, because, like I've been saying, if you and I were insulted by some drawing, I don't think we would go to those lengths. But what I said was, I think these people got lots of other grievances against the West, like we're in their face over in their country. I don't know if you heard earlier, but I was saying, what if Arab armies were fighting in Canada and Mexico and, you know, had bases in Puerto Rico and what have you? We'd be kind of in a fret about it.
Well,
I mean, that doesn't justify what they're doing. That kind of violence has to be condemned, you know, completely outright.
Well, anything. I mean, people are going to get offended no matter what. It doesn't have to be. Someone's going to get offended somewhere. And I just think that, you know what, people. I mean, this is America, and everybody's the right to an opinion. If it offends you, just shut up about it. Just like, you know what, that's just the way life goes.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, I'm obviously I agree with you, but. I guess they're going for a whole different thing, and we ought to resolve some of this, or it just creates more problems. All right, thank you. Let's go to Rob in Clinton Township. Hey, Rob, Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great.
I'm just amazed at all these people that are calling up trying to quote facts that don't exist about how the Republicans and Bush is doing anything useful at all for anyone.
Was anybody saying that tonight?
It seemed like there was too many people that wanted to support the war for ignorant reasons about terrorists and everything that we'd already proven a long time ago, multiple times, that aren't true at all.
Well, you know what we're getting now? We're getting that rump end, and I think that's the appropriate part of the anatomy, of the what's left of support for Bush. And I don't think there's a thing they could learn, a thing they could hear, an argument that could be put forth that would alter this slavish support of this corrupt, venal, ignorant man and his administration that does nothing except rob these people no more or less than it does you and me who oppose him, and yet they are so frightened of challenging authority they're going to give up essentially everything that defines a human being so that they can, as I said, slavishly support authority. They're really pathetic.
You know, it seems like our government's wanting to become more communistic than democratic ever, or more of an aristocracy than anything else.
Well,
really.
I think aristocracy, you got me on the word too. What is it? Aristocracy. It's, yeah, that's it. I mean, we're going to have to thatch our roofs soon, like during the Middle Ages. All right, I got to go. Thank you. Appreciate it. And one final caller, Tony from Howell. Tony, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Hi. It says you just want to say hello.
Yeah, long time listener, man. I've been listening for over 20 years and want to call in and, you know, so I really appreciate your show. About this whole situation over there, I just can't believe that so many people are falling into the trap of our government's just using our money, the middle and lower class citizens, to go fight to control the oil that they're going to make money off of. And what are they doing to us?
Yeah.
Jacking the gas prices up. And it makes me sick. And I can't, I mean, what's it going to take for us to finally come to an uprising, you know, where we take back control of our government and you know, shows like yours that get, you know, stuck on it at 11, 12 o'clock at night when, you know, I mean, I love your show. I agree with a lot of things that are said on there. How come they're never out in the mainstream?
Well, it's starting to. But you know what, Tony? You hit the key phrase. What's it going to take? I don't know. But one of the things that's got to happen is you could have said that, for instance, all through the 1920s and 1930s when our grandparents were involved in the union movement in the Detroit area. I mean, why didn't they do something in 1928 or 1934? Why did it take to 1937? These things have a, I don't know, kind of a mysterious character of their own. I mean, why didn't a Rosa Parks refuse to be humiliated the way black people were in the South in 1955 or 1954? In a way, there were. I mean, of course, they were repressed by terror. And things explode, and people demand a whole different way of of living. I think that's it. All right, I got to go. Thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Stay tuned. Got a number. The number is two of interesting interviews to follow.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Ready to party in paradise with the Poobah?
Back with a heart attack. Celebrating 20 years of Maui Time.
101 Riff and Budweiser are proud to present Maui Time 2006.
The concept!
Ready for some fun in the sun?
How'd you like to spend a week with the sunshine, the crystal blue water, and the black sands of Kahanapali Beach in Maui?
Why don't you tell him the whole story?
Then just listen for those three magic words.
Not yet!
Now, listen carefully for the directions.
When you hear them, be Motor City Caller 34 on the Rip Line.
And pack your bags, baby.
You and a guest could be getting the hell out of the cold. Partying with Arthur P. and the Riff in Maui. Maui Time, 2006.
20 years of Riff. Tradition continues.
From Budweiser. This is Budweiser. This is beer. At 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Baby!
WRIF.com.
The Detroit Symphony Orchestra presents Classical Fairy Tales, February 17th and 18th at the Mass. Celebrated conductor Charles Dutoit, renowned as a leading interpreter of French masterworks, joins the DSO with violinist Chantal Joullier for a program of fanciful works including Dukas the Sorcerer's Apprentice from the film Fantasia and Stravinsky's tragic love story of the puppet Petrushka. More information is available at 313-576-5111 or DetroitSymphony.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. You know, I used to talk about budgetary stuff and the economy, and I could just almost hear the radio dials switching all over the city. You know, people, oh, yeah. Well, now, though, it is much, much more on our mind. All over the United States, particularly here in Michigan, particularly here in the Detroit area. Joining me to talk about the Bush budget of $2.77 trillion and how it's going to affect us directly. Every one of us listening is Karen Dolan. Karen Dolan is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Karen Dolan, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
That's a lot of money, $2.77 trillion. And do we have it to spend?
Well, we certainly don't have all of it to spend. And the purpose of Bush's, of this particular proposal, with all of its cuts to crucial social programs, is to please his base by seeming to cut the deficit in half by 2009. So currently we have a record deficit in nominal terms, over $400 billion. And the guise of this budget is that by cutting these social programs like Medicaid, like education, like health, like cancer research, like food for poor elderly, that will show fiscal restraint and somehow reduce our budget deficit by 2009.
Well, on the face of it, one would think you have to do something. If you're going into debt or a family suddenly doesn't have as much money as it once did and has to begin borrowing, one has to cut back.
That's right, and one would think so, but what we've got to do is cut back in a way that makes sense. So the programs that are being cut, these what we call discretionary programs, programs for which the money is appropriated every year on domestic spending outside of Homeland Security and Defense, makes up about 1/6 of the budget.
Wow. Well, and there's a New York Times article that I had right in front of me. It seems to have gone away a little, but it says that essentially that Bush's priorities are security, and I think most of us would like to be secure in our homes and in our cities and not have a repeat of September 11th, as the mantra goes, and that also we'd like to have some fiscal responsibility. So how much is the one affecting the other? In other words, the military and security budget as terms affecting what we'd like to see domestically in our cities?
Well, that all depends on whether or not the huge amounts of money that are being spent on military, on Iraq, Afghanistan, and defense are actually making us safer. And I think that by all accounts, we've seen that they are not. In Iraq, we have created a terrorist haven that didn't exist before, and most Americans feel that this Iraq war has been misguided and, in fact, has not made us safer. And for the average American person, I would be willing to bet for your listeners, they're rather more concerned right now about how they're going to afford health care, about whether or not their children are going to be able to afford to go to college, about whether they're presently in a decent public school that has enough books for all children to have and to learn and to get ahead, whether or not their elderly parents will be able to afford end-of-life care or nursing home. These seem to be the more pressing security needs, if you will, for Americans, and it plays out that way in the polls. So with regard to whether or not this security spending is justified, we both have to look at whether or not it's making us safe, and on the other hand, what is it taking away from us in terms of our everyday bread and butter kind of community security at home.
You know, Karen Dolan, when you went through that list, I didn't have one sense of 100% sense of security on my end of things. And that's what's so mystifying in many ways. We claim bragging rights to the wealthiest country in the world, yet there is so much economic insecurity once you leave like the upper 5% of income in this country. And so much of what you would think could be a country that would be able to accomplish the goals in each of the areas that you mentioned easily, it's all a source of anxiety for us. What's happening here?
Well, that's right, and that is what a president's budget proposal is supposed to address. So when the president puts forth his budget proposal every February, he's telling us, these are my priorities. These are my moral priorities, if you will, for the country, for how we're going to deal with the problems that face us, for how we're going to ensure that everyone has a decent standard of living and is safe.
Well, what's the total, and sometimes there's even debate about this, of what military expenditures amount to in a year, because we have the official defense budget, then we have auxiliary spending for the wars, and then we have veterans' benefits and everything concerned with that. Is there a way to get a handle or identify either in percentage or total amount of revenue that takes up?
Well, the military budget officially is 51% of our whole discretionary budget pie, if you will. Homeland Security is another 6%, and international spending is another 4%. However, this even understates what's being spent on military, because it doesn't include the spending for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're approaching now the $300 billion mark for Iraq, and the president's new budget includes a bit of that spending, $70 billion supplemental that he's asking for Congress for spending in Iraq and a little bit in Afghanistan. However, that hasn't been included up until this year in terms of budgetary costs. So we've even got a skewed picture of how much is actually being spent. And, you know, there was a, I forget which pundit was quoted in saying so this week, but they likened the cutting of these social programs in order to reduce the budget to a family who has four, you know, top-of-the-line, fully loaded Hummer vehicles and says, oh, no, our budget is being stretched. We're going to have to buy a cheaper brand of peanut butter. So that's what we've got here with this budget. We've got four fully loaded Hummers, and we've got to switch from the Skippy brand of peanut butter to, you know, the local A&P or whatever the local grocery store is. And it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't change the budgetary outlook, and it doesn't do anything to shift the priorities to make the family safer.
Karen Dolan is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the 2007, is it? Are we into fiscal 07 accurately?
That's right. It's a little confusing because last week the Congress finally voted on the cuts for 2006. And our fiscal year in this country starts in October, so technically the fiscal year we're in currently, the funding should have started on October 1st. But for various reasons, these appropriation bills were kept in committee for all kinds of arguments that mostly that Democrats didn't want to cut social spending and Republicans did, and so there was sort of a fight. But of course, the conservative forces won out because they've got the majority in both houses and in the administration. So last week they passed cuts that were $40 billion in cuts to things like Medicare, to things like student loan programs, to things like child care services, at the same time increasing the burden on states for what they'll have to pay for their what we call TANF, temporary assistance to needy families, what we think of as our welfare services, our welfare to work program.
Well,
so we took a large hit in February 2006, and then this week the president introduced his proposal for fiscal year 2007 with more cuts on top.
Well, I did feel good. He did not mention again sending a man to Mars. So that was in, what, the 2005 speech we were talking about?
Yeah, there's always some gimmick or another in the State of the Union to make people feel patriotic and all of that. But I think that the fact that this State of the Union speech was very low-key on domestic issues and didn't have some of these more flashy programs is an indication that Bush certainly knows he's in trouble with the American people, and that his signature policies of Social Security privatization didn't go where he wanted them to go, and the tax cuts were a little bit less than they had been in the prior years, and there was more failure in Iraq, and his popularity has plummeted. So he was a little less flamboyant and bold with those kinds of propositions. However, this budget that he has proposed is very cynical. It hides a lot of cuts. Although he didn't mention Social Security privatization in his State of the Union speech, and in fact proposed a bipartisan commission to examine it, he has slipped into this proposal the privatization accounts that he proposed last year.
And I know that there's a $12 billion cut passed by the House in student loan subsidies. Now, that essentially makes college, which is already at astronomically high figures, that much more expensive for students.
It is. And as your listeners will know, any of them with college-age children, this tuition is just skyrocketing out of reach. And so this last budget put a squeeze on lending institutions that finance these student loans, which will cause them to raise interest rates on student loans, which will in turn raise tuition. And the upcoming budget has more cuts to education. In Michigan, currently, this isn't for the higher education, but for vocational education, Michigan receives about $40 million for vocational education. Under this current proposal, Bush will eliminate all of that funding.
Oh, no. Just what we need.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And people should realize, by the way, when we talk about federal government giving us, we have given them. The federal government only has money that they gain through mostly through taxes. And there's always a proportion that goes to the federal government, and then we get it back in different services and what have you. And I think, as I remember, as it is, states like Michigan, we send out more than we get back, as I remember.
Well, you'll be getting back less.
Okay.
In the coming years. So it's a very harsh budget, in other words. And where the cuts are coming from don't make sense if the true goal was to reduce the budget deficit. So the tax cuts that have been enacted so far already contribute 40% of deficit spending, as compared to something like less than 10% of domestic spending. So it's really a very skewed budget and the wrong way to go about trying to achieve any of the goals that we need in this country.
Well, Karen Dolan, you mentioned earlier about Bush proposing a budget that plays to his base, and normally we think of that as an electoral base. That is, people who identify themselves as conservatives, evangelicals, whoever else. But you may remember, if you saw it in Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11, with this famous, Bush is at this speech and he's got a tuxedo on, he's talking to other people in tuxedos, and he said, I forgot, something like, some people call you the elite, I call you my base. Mm-hmm. And essentially, he's then talking to like the upper 1%, and these tax cuts overwhelmingly benefit the ultra-rich, the 1%, the 5% at best. And although that may be his actual base, it doesn't seem to do him much good in terms of electoral success. I mean, people are beginning to more and more chafe at what's happening in this country economically. More and more we think we're getting ripped off by what we're spending on the war, gas prices, and any number of other things. So why this insistence on giving the already wealthy more tax breaks? It doesn't make a bit of sense to me.
Well, it actually has been a very successful electoral strategy up until now. I think that my personal opinion is that the Republicans have overreached, have overplayed their hand, and public opinion is reflecting that. However, where the funding comes for the Republican Party largely, and for keeping this segment of politicians in power, is from the wealthy and the business interests in this country. So with the prescription drug benefit, we have rhetoric that says this is for our seniors, this is to help them afford their prescription drugs, when in reality the benefit was written as a privatization scheme to enrich pharmaceutical companies and private insurers. They are the only true beneficiaries of this plan. And the government, Medicare, was prohibited in this law from negotiating directly with drug companies to negotiate down the prices. So you see an increase in prices, you see, because it's become privatized, that there are so many private plans that it is just a confusing mess right now, and people are falling through the cracks all over the place. We've got over 25 states in the District of Columbia that have had to try to step in and pick up the tab and try to pull people up through the cracks and try to pay for their coverage while this mess is being worked out. So you took an efficient, relatively efficient Medicare program and to cater to the business interests that keep the Republicans in power, what the average person is the one that suffers, yet the rhetoric is, this is for you, grandma and grandpa, this is so that you can get the coverage that you need. The same is with his proposal for health savings accounts in the new budget. These health savings accounts are, again, another privatization scheme. So it's being offered as, yes, I hear you, American people. Health care is skyrocketing. We need a way to be able to control the costs and to ensure the 46 million people that are uninsured, 5 million more of whom have been added in Bush's watch. So I'm going to give you health care savings accounts. That means those of you who can set aside $2,000 into a savings account won't have to pay taxes on that, and you can do that as long as you sign up for a private health plan that has a high deductibility of $2,000.
Wow.
And you may withdraw that money tax-free to pay these out-of-pocket costs. Now, he's proposing expanding this up to $10,000 deductible for couples or families. So I'm willing to bet that your average listener is saying, well, my family is not going to be able to set aside $10,500 to pay out-of-pocket for our health costs this coming year.
That's absolutely incredible. In fact, there is great enthusiasm for this plan, at least among the banks.
Read.
They would make a nice, tidy little sum.
There's great enthusiasm, again, among the sectors that will help to keep these folks in power.
Well, Karen Dolan, I know through the Institute for Policy Studies that you have some more just figures on what Bush's budget is going to, or how it's going to affect, the cuts particularly going to affect the state of Michigan. Maybe you could just run off a list of those.
Well, Michigan stands to lose about $5 million in WIC funding, so food and nutritional programs for women, babies, and children. Michigan will also lose a little over $30 million in community development block grants, and these help cities like Detroit and towns to ensure affordable housing, to provide services, to create jobs. The loss to Detroit will be $8.9 million, and Grand Rapids will lose almost $1 million in these community development block grants, which are very, very important to cities and towns, as I'm sure your listeners know.
Mm-hmm.
We have a loss. Michigan will have a loss of almost 800 Head Start slots. And you mentioned the low-income energy assistance program of how we can afford these rising energy costs, especially where it tends to be quite cold in Michigan. And Michigan would be slated under this proposal to lose almost $10 million in that funding.
Well, you know, Karen, I could imagine, because sometimes I get, when I do phone-in talk shows, get middle-class, angry white guys that saying, you know, essentially you're talking about the poor. You know, I worked hard. I made what I have to make. Well, I don't want my tax dollars going to those people that, you know, that aren't productive. And so they might just say, well, you know, too bad. I'd rather have a balanced budget. I'd rather be secure. And so you're not, my compassion level is fairly low. So practically, I just don't even give a damn. I mean, how do you answer that? Or
Well, sure, except that the budget that Bush has proposed actually increases the deficit every year rather than decreasing it. So we'll end up with higher budget deficits each year in the foreseeable future and beyond. So he doesn't actually come anywhere close to achieving a balanced budget. In fact, the opposite is achieved. And in terms of the health care proposals, really these are something that will only be affordable for the very wealthy and will only benefit the benefit of these tax shelters increase with your tax bracket. So the highest amount of the benefits go to the ultra wealthy, and the benefit for a middle income family is just a few hundred dollars rather than several hundred thousand dollars at the very top end of the scale. So these really are cuts that affect everyone except the super wealthy and a very small portion of our society, while at the same time not but balancing the budget but creating a larger deficit for our kids.
And a lot of us live on a deficit, credit card debt particularly. Most of us, if we're lucky enough to own a home, owe money on our home. We pay on our car. So one could make the argument, big deal. So what if we have deficit spending? How does that hurt us?
Well, then we'll eventually, and that the predictions for the health crisis are that the especially employer-based health programs will unravel in the next couple of years, that we have a real crisis in there. And as the deficits increase, of course, so does the interest and the payment of the interest on these on the deficit. And so what we're doing is creating an unworkable situation for our children. We already have a country with the largest gap between the rich and the poor. So it's not as if this is a benign policy. It's a policy which is increasing the gap between the wealthy and then the less wealthy and folks who are in the middle class. That middle class is disappearing. And relatively soon, if we keep on this path, things like decent education, never mind second college education, but just a decent primary education, are going to be elusive for all but the very wealthy. And health care certainly is not sustainable in the path that we're on. And the proposals that Bush has made, The Economist magazine this month predicted that all this will do is hasten the unraveling of our entire health system. So these are hardly benign proposals, and not one that it would behoove any of us to put our head in the sand and pretend it's not happening or won't affect us.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I think is so troubling to Americans is that we feel that we're confronting this juggernaut of power and wealth and privilege of which we as a single individual can do very, very little. We don't get, that there was an opposition party in this country worthy of the name. If there was, what would this budget look like? If it suddenly was turned over to Karen Dolan and the Institute for Policy Studies, what would it look like more?
Well, I think the most obvious place, the most obvious reform that needs to happen is in rolling back these tax cuts that have gone overwhelmingly to the top 1% and 2% of Americans. That is where most of the cost of the deficit is coming from. That is why these social programs are being cut. They're not actually being cut in order to reduce the deficit, because this budget plan simply increases the deficit. These cuts are being forced on people in order to finance tax cuts for the very wealthy. And that is not a particularly popular issue with the American people.
Let me just give you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, because we just have about 30 seconds left. Is this budget and the House passed budget just raw meat for the base, and will many of these cuts be restored in the Senate?
Yes, it isn't likely that a lot of these cuts will be able to go through in an election year. The Republicans also have to face the music at home. So this, by and large, is symbolic, And one should take heed of what it means in terms of the priorities that are being expressed by our president. But a lot of this won't go through. However, so much damage has already been done. The $40 billion that was just cut this past year, which incidentally is the price of the administrative cost of implementing the health savings accounts.
Hmm.
So what, you know, what listeners can do is to hold their own elected officials accountable, be them Democrat or Republican. I think that we've succumbed to the fear factor the last several election cycles and just trusted that all of this spending was making us safer, and now we're realizing that that isn't exactly true.
Well, thank you, Karen, for joining us. Karen Dolan is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written the articles Budget of Shame and the report Paying the Price, the Mounting Cost of War in Iraq, and those are on the website, am I correct?
I think so.
Yeah, ips-dc.org. Karen Dolan, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
This is WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
They're stretching your dollar. Bottom line is, they want you to exercise your buying options with them. With treadmills from Bodyguard, ellipticals from Spirit, bikes from Sports Art, and home gym tough stuff, you can have health club quality equipment in your home at prices you can't afford to miss. Fitness Things New Year's resolution is to bring value to the new you with savings of up to 25% on 2005 floor models. Or you can take advantage of their 12-month same as cash. 2006 models are available at sale prices, and you can even trade in your old equipment. Fitness Things delivers all over the Metro Detroit area, but to visit them, you need to go to the beautiful city of Plymouth. They're at 1160 West Ann Arbor Road. Look for the Muscle Man mailbox. For more information on Fitness Things products and services, call 734-455-8790 or log on their website at fitnessthings.com. That's 734-455-8790 or fitnessthings.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about immigration. And when we start talking about immigration, it involves lots of different people from around the world. The concern of many people in the United States, as it is in Europe, is with people from the Middle East. And when I want to want really straight information, when I want good, solid information about that phenomena, I go to People from Access. That's the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. Many of you may remember my last interview with Ishmael Ahmed, who told us about the Arab American Museum in Dearborn. Joining me today is Noel J. Salah, and he's the president of Access's Board of Directors, and he's currently on a sabbatical from the practice of law. He did specialized in immigration law, hence has the ability to give us a lot of information, and also someone I know. In fact, Noel Salah, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, well, it's a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
I'm thinking about only having people on that I know. But anyways, let's get to a lot of these issues. On some of the talking points that your publicist sent me, one phrase says, these newcomers, the immigrants, are integral to our communities and interwoven into the economic, cultural, and political fabric of our society. Well, that certainly is the ideal, but if we look back on our history, way back into the 19th century, immigrants never got a very good welcome, did they?
No, I think historically and traditionally, immigrants have always been the scapegoat for hard times. You know, we always welcomed immigrants to this country because, as you suggest, immigrants contributed and made this country what it is. But then whenever we're in an economic threat, whether it's or a political or military threat, then immigrants always become the scapegoats for the problem. And this is just a situation where we would hope we'd learn better from history and not continually repeat this mistake. But
we do. We do indeed. And if you think even back to the 1840s when the Irish arrived and there were signs that said, job available, no Irish need apply.
Absolutely.
And then you go to the Italians, the Jews, the Asians, and always looked upon with suspicion. I'll just tell you a real quick story. I'll get some flack at home if I identify who this is, but an older woman who was living in senior housing was complaining about all these Russian immigrants and saying, why don't they learn our language? And she said, when I came here from Russia, I learned English in 2 weeks. Which, of course,
she did not.
Exactly. So even those who went through the immigrant experience are often, if it's someone else, and these days, people, immigrants from the Middle East, have really arisen in the popular, in many parts of the popular consciousness as the other or the other person, a citizens or immigrants under suspicion. And that must be a special challenge for you and Access, no?
Well, it certainly has been a challenge, even before 9/11, but certainly since 9/11, it has created a new sense of urgency in terms of how we perform our services,
and how we communicate to the society at large in terms of who we are as Arab immigrants, who we are as Arab Americans, and how we are Americans and part of the society. So I'm glad to know, and I remember that your program with Ishmael on the museum, that certainly was the major purpose for developing the museum, was to tell the Arab American experience from the Arab American point of view, but with special emphasis on the fact that we are Americans participating in an American society, and we have a unique contribution, just like all other immigrant groups have.
Now, I would certainly recommend to everyone that they go to the Arab American Museum in Dearborn on Michigan Avenue at Schaefer. It's a wonderful experience, and I know a lot of people in Dearborn, I thought, well, I knew a lot of this, but it was just startling, the gaps in my information and the quality of presentation, so I would highly recommend that. Now, you mentioned 9/11. That, in many ways, was such an extraordinary setback from an immigrant group that was beginning to distinguish itself as individuals and suddenly is lumped together as, quote, Arabs, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in a lot of ways, hasn't ended, has it?
No, it really hasn't, Peter. It's the most extreme of it, we hope, has died down, but it still has a day-to-day, real, tangible effect on our community. September 12th, if you drove through the Arab community in Dearborn, you would have thought it was 4th of July with all the flags flying, because people, for two reasons. One, people felt a real concern about backlash. And two, they wanted to have a very clear manifestation that, yes, we're here, and we're here as Americans. We're not quote unquote the enemy. But unfortunately, a lot of the government response, especially in the area of immigration law, has been one which has had a very onerous effect on immigrants. It's become a very unforgiving environment, and it's made it very difficult for people to attempt to comply with the laws. And perhaps the most dramatic one is not yet the law, but there was passed last December the Sensenbrenner-King bill in the U.S. House of Representatives, which, if this becomes the law, would literally criminalize status. It would make it criminal for someone to be here out of immigration status. And worse than that, it would criminalize any individual or organization who assisted this person. And for access, that just has tremendous ramifications. We receive government funds, but we receive a lot of private funds and our own donations. And with these private funds and donations, we're able to provide educational programs for documented and undocumented immigrants. We're able to provide health care services for documented and undocumented immigrants. If this became law, we would not be able to provide these services because it would be a felony punishable by up to 20 years in prison, the same amount of time as an actual, a smuggler would get for smuggling somebody in. And this doesn't apply just to access. This applies to your local church who maybe has a food baskets for people in need in the community, or has clothing for families in need. Your local church couldn't provide those food baskets. They couldn't provide the clothing. They couldn't provide shelter. because they too would be prohibited by law, because this would be a crime.
Mm-hmm. And the same issue. I know I was talking to, of all people, a psychotherapist in Caracas, Venezuela, when I was there a few weeks ago for the World Social Forum. And he said that he does a lot of work with Latin American immigrants on issues of domestic violence. And he said that if someone came to him and he was saying advice, say, you know, it's not a good idea to beat up your wife or your kids, that he would essentially, under this law, be a felon. So it's a
that's right.
And all the services. So this is a great issue in California and Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, there as well. My guest is Noel Sala, and he is the president of the Access Board of Directors in Dearborn. We're talking about immigration. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. Now, I can imagine a lot of people saying, "Hey, these people are in our country illegally. Why should they get any kind of services? They're taking our jobs. They commit crimes, and we've got to get a handle on this." I certainly there's two aspects. One is with Latin American immigrants and illegal undocumented people in this country. It's a concern about jobs. Very frequently among people of Middle East origin, it's fear of terrorism. So you have these two big kind of bugaboos: security and jobs. That I think could get a lot of support for an act like this.
They could, but they shouldn't. I mean, it's true that there is a substantial immigration problem that our country is facing. The Government Accounting Office estimates that there may well be up to 11 million undocumented individuals in the United States. But the vast, and I mean the vast majority of those individuals, are here doing jobs that Americans don't seem to be ready, willing, or able to perform, for the most part. So that, the gardeners, the many construction jobs and so forth, they're filling a void that's needed in our economy. These jobs wouldn't be filled by undocumented persons were there not the demand for it in the part of the industry. People are making tax payments on this income. They're contributing to the society much the same way as earlier waves of immigrants did. And so it's really misplaced, I think, to create this as a criminal situation. What really needs to be approached is, how do you, now that you have this situation, how do you best address it? How do you integrate people into the society in a structured, fair fashion? And then how do you make certain that American employers are making reasonable jobs available for all Americans?
Mm-hmm.
If these jobs weren't here, if the American employers weren't offering and looking and filling these positions, then the demand, the undocumented worker wouldn't be here.
Yeah, particularly in the case of Latin Americans, that if their economies there were brought up to speed in a manner that wouldn't impel people to find jobs below minimum wage sometimes attractive over the border. In other words, if their economies were a lot fairer, we'd find quite a few less people even making the journey here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I frequently hear is a lot of myths about immigrants. And again, they differ from region to region, whether they're, if you're in the Southwest, in California, it's one thing, whether you're in Michigan in the East, it's more, frequently people from the Middle East. And I was told on a talk show that I do, under no uncertain terms, that Middle Eastern immigrants don't pay any taxes on their businesses, and that's why they can get, that's why they have so many businesses in the area. So it's even if you do good, if you're not doing good, you got the one set of stereotypes on you. If you're doing good, you got another.
This is one of the most prevailing urban myths, and it just really won't die. I mean, primarily it happens, I think, because new immigrants in the Metro Detroit area. That means primarily Arab immigrants in the gas stations and then the party stores. You know, they come together as a family. They work 14, 16, 18-hour days for little or no money. They pool their money. They get this business together and up and running. And they tend to be somewhat successful in doing this. And so the, you know, what turns out in this area to be the, you know, the poorer community and or the poorer community in the African American community, they see this and they say, well, you know, we've been here for generations and we're not able to get these stores and businesses together. It must be that they're getting special tax breaks. And that's just not true. I mean, you know, an immigrant coming to the United States is required to pay every tax that anyone is required to pay. And indeed, you know, under existing laws, you know, for at least the first 10 years of an immigrant's presence in the United States, they're ineligible to receive any form of public assistance. This would be a violation of their immigrant status, and it could render them deportable. So, I mean, it's not just that they don't get these free tax breaks that everybody talks about, but indeed they have even a stricter code of conduct requirement than an American citizen for fear of losing their status in the United States.
Now, that's one of the myths, and again, more predominant among Latin American immigrants, that they come here specifically to get welfare because, gee, everyone knows you can just live terrifically on welfare. But, Noel Sala, another one of the myths is that and this is true of both groups, although the, you know, you got to remember there's lots of other immigrant groups, but probably, am I correct in saying probably Latin American immigrants are way higher, the highest, and among undocumented, followed by Middle Eastern. We got a lot of Polish and Irish people without documents running around as well, but primarily it's the first two groups.
Well, certainly in the Metro Detroit area, that would be true.
Yeah, and the idea is, both in terms of Latin American and Middle Eastern, is that the men come here at work, and then all the money goes back home.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back home. It's to support families. I mean, the men will come here and literally live, you know, in a one-bedroom apartment. Five or six different men will live there, taking shifts, sleeping and working, you know, and keeping their expenses to a minimum so that they can build, even from minimum wages, this sort of money that they need to be sending back to their homes and supporting their families back home.
Mm-hmm.
Or ultimately bringing their families here when they've acquired enough savings to do that.
Well, you know, another myth is that they really don't want to be integrated. Either the Latin American people who want to keep speaking Spanish, or people that immigrate from the Middle East want to keep speaking Arabic. But I mean, again, this is a myth that goes back 100 years. They just want to keep talking Italian. They just want to keep talking Yiddish. They just keep want to talking German. But what's your sense within? I mean, when I go to Dearborn, and I love to go there because I love the food, I love the culture, I love the you know, the music, and somehow for it to all turn out like, I hope I'm not stepping, I shouldn't name any sort of white bread suburb, and that would be a tragedy to lose this unique culture that we are so fortunate, along with the Latin American cultures and the rest of them, to have this incredible diversity that people can, in some ways, have a foot in both cultures, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and you may come to these, you know, impacted communities, whether it's, you know, the Dearborn area with the Arab community or Southwest Detroit with the Hispanic community, and you'll see businesses that are multilingual. But that's really an attempt to sort of, as you say, maintain a cultural identity, but that doesn't mean that they're not at the same time integrating themselves into the larger American society. And like any immigrant group, you know, it may take 2 to 3 generations before they're totally acculturated. But I think what we're seeing now, And that continues to happen with every wave of immigration. But I think what we're seeing now, and I think in large part in thanks to the civil rights movement and the black power movement in the 60s, is a greater recognition that diversity is a strength in this country, and that having a distinct cultural identity that you can share, that comes, that makes up the whole, the concept of the quilt, you know, that the patches, these individual patches have some identity, but together they make up the fabric of the quilt. They make the quilt work well. That's really what we're talking about in America, is we have a quilt work of racial and ethnic groups that, in recognizing their individuality and then coming together as a whole, is what makes this country strong. And we really need to continue to remember that.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the attractions I have for other people's ethnic expressions of their culture is that I'm just such an American mongrel that I, you know, what do I have? Roast beef and mashed potatoes and, you know, some, you know, so the idea that there are people here from Asia, from Latin America, from the Middle East, and you know, parts of Europe, to me, has always been exciting. Yet, I'm sure that in every Hispanic home, every Middle Eastern home, just like there were in Italian and Jewish and German homes, that there's a kid saying, "Ma, talk English. We're in America now," right?
Absolutely.
So they're driving, you know, away from the sort of the pure ethnicity, and that's in a way a gain and a loss. But is there a special sense, Noel Salah, within the Middle Eastern community? I mean, in many ways, that community is actually, as I said, I think I used this phrase before, a group under suspicion. In other words, it seems like almost you have to say, well, you know, I don't support 9/11, you know, what happened in 9/11. I don't support Osama bin Laden. I don't support, you know, riots in the Middle East. Whereas no one ever asked me to denounce Timothy McVeigh. Right? No one's,
Yeah.
Hey, he was a white European, you know, no one would make the assumption. Why is there that pressure on people of Middle Eastern abstraction to almost begin every public statement with a declaration that you don't support terrorism?
You know, I think the pressure is external, it's not internal. I mean, it's perhaps both. Externally, I mean, we're a community that is under suspicion. And while the government may say otherwise, you know, we have to look to their behavior. You know, they announce new programs where they're sending FBI agents with radiation detection devices going to religious institutions, you know, to monitor for radioactivity. The FBI publicly pronounces that they have increased tenfold their presence in the Dearborn community since 9/11. We have immigration programs such as in Sears, which requires every male from 22 different Arab and Muslim countries to come in and register and be and to be interviewed on their status and legitimacy of their status in the United States. I mean, you go from one program after the other, and it sends a very strong message to the community at large, and it sends an equally, if not stronger, message to the Arab and Muslim community that the first thing out of your mouth in a situation such as the cartoon situation is, we don't support that. It's not us.
Yeah. Well, it would appear I wonder if who's making this is maybe on the extremists and the right wingers on both sides, that there is this clash of civilizations, clash of religions, and when we see like people that are arrested for aiding Al Qaeda, they do have Middle Eastern names. So someone would say, well, doesn't it make a little sense to, you know, you're not going to look for Chinese immigrants, although some of them are Muslim, that it would make sense to give special attention to a community that could potentially, that's the frightening word, potentially give support to the enemies of the United States.
Well, as you suggested, Peter, following the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, the government didn't go on a policy and campaign of profiling every white Christian male in a certain age group, and it's inappropriate to do it in the Arab and Muslim communities as well. You know, that may be a factor, but unfortunately, at least it's our perception, and I think it's shared public perception, is that that is the major factor, as opposed to one item amongst a large number of others.
Now, this may be a big one for just about 30 or 40 seconds left, but what's ahead? What does particularly Detroit's Middle Eastern community and citizens look for in the coming months? Things getting better? Are they getting worse?
Well, I think that I'm very proud of the response of the Arab American community in the Metro Detroit area, because I think we've taken a very proactive response in our organizations and institutions, where we're reaching out to the government and we're saying, hey, we want to work with you, we want you to understand us, and we want to better understand you, so that we're going into a mutual education process. But unfortunately, that doesn't... So our biggest challenge, though, is translating that on to a national level. I, you know, that's what we're looking forward to, is working together to make our region and our country stronger and more secure, and at the same time making our region and our country understand more that we're part of the society.
And that's exactly what the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services does, Access. And some of you may recall, too, is that it is Access that puts on the wonderful free Concert of Colors every summer in Detroit. My guest has been Noel J. Sala. He's the president of Access's board of directors. And, you know, I didn't, you guys got a website, right?
We do. www.accesscommunity.org.
Yeah, and remember the museum that's on the corner of Michigan Avenue and Schaefer in Dearborn, a real Detroit area gem. Thank you, Noel Sala.
Thank you, Peter Werby.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.